Good afternoon. Welcome on into Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM. It's Caoimhe Hearney with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Mary Kenny. She's a writer, columnist with the Irish Times, Irish Independent, and she's a broadcast and playwright. And she says we should drop the phrase toxic masculinity and find positive ways to let boys be boys. Then we'll be speaking to Dr. Samuel White. He's a senior lecturer in genetic immunology at the Department of Animal, Equine and Veterinary Sciences at Nottingham Trent University. He'll be giving us tips on how to boost your immune system if you are feeling sick. And then we'll be speaking to Barry Kennedy. He's a spokesperson for the Irish Hotels Federation, the Midlands branch, and he's saying hotels are facing uncertain economic environments in 2023 and they are calling on the government to retain that 9% tourism VAT rate. And then lastly, we'll be speaking to Leslie Townsend. She's a dog trainer with Clever Companions and she'll be telling us how to prepare your dog for a new arrival. So do stay tuned for that. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, you know what to do.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, we should drop the phrase toxic masculinity and find positive ways to let boys be boys. That's according to Mary Kenny, journalist and columnist with the Irish Independent. She's also a broadcaster and playwright. And Mary Kenny joins me now on the line. Good afternoon, Mary.
Hi, hello.
Mary, tell us a little bit about this and your thinking behind it, I suppose.
Well, it's really drawing on the research is done by an American specialist called Richard Reeves, who works for a major institution in the United States. And he wrote a book called Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling. And he builds up a very interesting picture, which, of course, I'd heard about anecdotally anyway from teachers and from parents, which really shows that pretty well all over the world in global statistics gathered by the OECD, that boys are very, very often behind girls in education. I mean, there's a small cohort of very clever boys, but a lot of average boys are really, really, you know, behind. Girls are achieving much, much more. I mean, the fact that girls are achieving a lot in education is, of course, terrific, but there is a lot of concern about boys. I mean, for example, in Finland, which is supposed to have the best education system in the world, 20% of girls at the age of 15 are at the very highest level in English, in language and maths. But only 9% of boys are at that level of reading and of math. So that's quite a big gap. And in fact, the pupils who are at the bottom level are almost all boys. So, you know, that's an extraordinary reflection, really, on the way in which boys develop much more slowly and are, Richard Reeves thinks, are often really neglected in the education system. And he thinks some teachers are actually prejudiced against the very idea of masculinity. So I was just reporting on that and offering my own thoughts on it.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Mary, because Richard Reeves says in his study that men have lost their breadwinner role and feel a loss of purpose and utility. And it's something that struck me because I remember my grandmother, she's passed away now, but she said to me, you know, it was in a way easier for men and women years ago because their roles were much more defined. The woman stayed at home, looked after the children, you know, looked after things that domestically, and the men went out, made the money and were the providers. And that has totally gone astray now, and it's quite skewed, maybe in a good way, but it's difficult maybe for men perhaps to deal with.
Yes, obviously, indeed, that's a very good point. I mean, I would, the one exception, I think, to that picture is in farming, in agriculture, and a Harvard anthropologist came to Ireland in the 1930s, and he actually discovered that between men and women in farming, although the men did the heavy things on the land and the women tended to look after the small animals and the chickens, nevertheless, there was a lot of sort of mutual cooperation cooperation in farming, you know, because people had to work together. So there was, even though the roles were recognized as being separate, nevertheless, in agriculture, there was a lot of very good cooperation. You know, I mean, I suppose in a way you nearly need a family to run a farm, you know, because everybody has to pitch in. But you're quite right in saying with industrialization and with urbanization, men, of course, tended to go out to work and mothers stayed at home. And he goes over that very much. And of course, some women were contented to stay at home, and quite a lot of women also still like to be part-time at work because they still do want to spend time with their children. But a lot of girls are very ambitious and clever, and I'm delighted to see my own granddaughters are brilliant at things like physics and maths, which I was complete dunce at. So it's great to see that coming on. But I do think it's an interesting point that Richard Reeves makes about how, you know, the education of boys and girls really, he thinks, should be different. Because he says at age 16, for example, girls are just much more mature than boys. And I suppose mothers have always noticed that in an anecdotal way. You know, I remember when my own sons were they were at a single-sex school, but some girls were brought in at the age of 16, and these boys were just absolutely floored by the sophistication and poise of girls at 16, whereas the lads were still complete omadhons, you know. And I suppose, so we've noticed that anecdotally, and he's bringing that into the research picture.
Yeah, and he says here that he thinks that boys should have an extra year in school, Mary, as well, be given more hands-on vocational education and practical apprenticeships too.
Yes, he's very keen on that. And he just says boys need to be sort of doing things more, whereas girls are sort of probably better at study. Of course, there's a lot of research going on now into the development of the human brain. You know, there's a lot of neurological research on that, and a lot of human brains take a long time to mature as well. But as you say, of course, he's looking at the bigger picture, where things like free trade, for example, where you've got globalized trade, have undermined men's traditional jobs. I mean, men, until recently, men did all the jobs in things like transport and the heavy lifting jobs. And with free trade, a lot of jobs have gone to countries where the wages are lower, frankly. So men in the developed countries have sort of lost out. And of course, there is a kind of rather worrying side to all this. I mean, you note the Swedes have a special category for these problem young men. In Japan, there's a group of young men who've completely withdrawn because they feel they can't cope with the changes in the world, in a way. He really thinks we have to think about this and how we are going to correct it. Because after all, women don't want their own sons to be caught up in this. What he looks at is a sort of a loser culture, where men are going on the internet and they're angry and they're resentful and so on because they have lost their role really in life. And I suppose it is really worth thinking about this and how we can kind of look at the gender gap in another way.
Yeah, and I know you don't like the word toxic masculinity, Mary, but I suppose if we look at that and what it means, or what, you know, the media or the society as what we think it means now, obviously it's that, it's kind of Andrew Tate. I'm sure you're au fait with him, and that kind of, men are better than women, they're stronger, they're, you know, we have ownership, we have, we should be making more money, leads to, increased crime rate maybe and violence. Do you think there's a correlation between the loss of that role and the rise in this kind of behaviour among young men?
Well, I suppose you know, we'd have to do a lot more research on that. But I suppose, again, anecdotally, I mean, I suppose when I was growing up in Ireland, back in the 1950s and 60s, crime was very, very low indeed. I mean, Ireland was known for its, but probably that might have been correlated with the fact that quite a lot of young men emigrated. So we don't really know what the answer is. But what Richard Rees is saying, I think, about toxic masculinity, this phrase sort of stigmatizes the very concept of masculinity. And he says there's nothing wrong with being masculine, you know, as long as it's used in a kind of good and constructive way. And boys are getting a sort of negative messages about this. He also thinks that some female teachers are prejudiced against boys, and he thinks that there needs to be more men teaching in schools as well, because the teaching profession has become much more dominated by women, and he thinks that a lot of boys, probably particularly those who are growing up in single-parent situations, they do need these good role models of men who are teaching them properly. And, you know, this is something that's he really thinks that the teaching profession has to address. I suppose some people, I mean, I think Ireland has more single-sex schools than many other countries. And perhaps some single-sex schools are suited better to some boys and to some girls. I mean, I'm sure it's much better for parents to have the choice of where they want to send their children to school. But obviously, according to the researchers, some boys might benefit more from that kind of good masculine atmosphere.
Okay, it's so interesting, Mary, and thank you for joining us today. Mary Kenny there, journalist and columnist with the Irish Independent, broadcaster and playwright, saying that we should drop the phrase toxic masculinity and find positive ways to let boys be boys. Thanks very much, Mary.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, Kildare hotels are facing uncertain economic environments in 2023, and they have called on the government to retain the 9% tourism VAT rate beyond the February cut-off point. And I'm joined now on the line by Barry Kennedy. He's spokesperson for the Irish Hotels Federation Midlands branch. Good afternoon, Barry.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe. Thank you for having me on.
Of course, Barry. Barry, tell us a little bit about why you think that hotels are facing uncertain economic environments. I mean, most businesses are this year.
Yeah, absolutely, Caoimhe. I suppose we feel very strongly about this matter. We have just come through in the last few years that the challenge of the pandemic, which was very damaging to hospitality and to hotels. We were closed for a large period, and really we're just getting back on our feet. Hospitality and hotels, by their nature, it's very much a cash in, cash out business. So it, you know, we don't have huge reserves. So coupled with the huge levels of cost increases we've seen, and everybody has seen in the last few months, really would be massively damaging to hotels countrywide.
Okay, and I know Ireland is kind of an outlier in terms of the VAT rate previous to this 9%, which was 13.5%. Can you give us the information on the VAT rate in other countries?
Sure. Well, like at the moment we're very competitively positioned at 9%, and really it's where we should be as a country. If we were to go to 13.5%, which is what's been touted, you know, we would become an outlier. We'd be the second highest VAT level within the EU, and other countries such as Spain, Italy, France, you know, Cyprus, Turkey, Germany and Portugal would all be in a much stronger position with much lower VAT rates. These are countries that are very dependent on tourism, as is Ireland. If we were to go to 13.5% of the VAT rate, I think it would be very damaging to visitors to our country. And really, if the government are serious about tourism in our country, they really need to maintain VAT at 9%.
Okay, how did the hotels fare last year, Barry? Did you bounce back from COVID, or what were the reservations like?
Yeah, last year was an encouraging year. We certainly saw growth in terms of visitors. We saw growth in terms of employee numbers, but we're still not at the same level as we were Previous to that, occupancy last year was across the country in hotels was 70%. If you look back to 2019, pre-COVID occupancy was at 78, almost 80%. So not fully recovered, but certainly signs of hope. But that was largely dependent on the 9% VAT rate and attracting people to the country.
Okay. I suppose when we look at, obviously you're saying that other EU countries, like if we keep the 9% VAT rate, then we're kind of on par and you know, level with that. But I suppose, like, look, people are going to say, well, every sector is facing high costs. Every sector has bills to pay. And why should there be special treatment given to the tourism sector?
Yeah, and I completely understand where people are coming from. But what we're hearing is that throughout the country, if you look at the use of hotels for housing Ukrainians who are fleeing the awful war, is that the knock-on of having those rooms held for Ukrainians is that the local economy is suffering, and it's suffering because there's not people staying in the hotels, and they're not, you know, they're not using the cafes, the shops, the restaurants in those towns and in those cities. So to me, that's an indicator that if we increase our VAT to 13.5%, we become a lot less attractive to overseas visitors. Less of them will come, and that will also have a knock-on effect in the local economies, which is something the country really cannot afford to have right now.
Okay. Give us an idea of the increased costs. Like, where are the biggest increases that you're seeing yourself, Barry?
Sure. Like, if you're in my own hotel, I'm based here in County Offaly in Burr. If you look at where we are now versus where we were in 2019, like energy bills have gone up almost 300%. You know, that's 12% now is what I pay yearly as a percentage of on energy as a percentage of the revenue versus as low as 4% in 2019. Food suppliers have gone up and continue to go up. We're paying between 25 and 30% now on various food items compared to 2019, similar with beverage and linen hire. So linen for like bedrooms and tablecloths and that sort of stuff, that's gone up as high as 30% and above. And even insurance costs have gone very close to 20%. So all costs are rising. And realistically, I mean, if we increase that by what would be a 50% increase on the VAT, you know, it would lead a lot of businesses into potentially a loss-making situation, which can't really be something we could find sustainable.
Okay, we have a text in here to 0833 97 97 97. No sympathy for the hotels. They have robbed us tourists for the last 20 years. €450 a night in 2022. Never will I set foot in the Irish hotels again. Pure riff-boff. That's from May. And Barry, I have to say, like, we get a lot of those messages in, and we hear what usually the Irish Hotels Federation say, you know, hotels abroad aren't on par, etc., etc. Just for example, I'm going to Lisbon in a couple of weeks' time, and for 4 nights in genuinely now really, really nice hotel, it's €375. Now, I wouldn't get one night in a hotel, I would say, down the country for the same quality as what I'm getting there. So you can understand why people are quite angry. And what would your response be to that?
Yeah, I can understand why people, of course, are angry. We did see some hotel prices and some dates where headline rates were reported to be quite high. It's not really reflective of the situation countrywide. Again, my own hotel here, our average room rate across 2022 was €160 bed and breakfast for two people. That's very good value. And we do. We're very lucky in this country. We have a really world-class offering, and we do offer great value. And some of the headline rates that that were touted last year and reported on did happen. It happened in some cases, but in the vast, vast majority of cases, hoteliers are very responsible and maintained a very good standard whilst obviously keeping a good rate too. Everything has gone up. And I mean, hotel rates versus 2019 are gone up 16%. But if you look at the cost that I just outlined to you, and you know, far in excess of 16%, our costs have gone up. So that's where we are with the rates.
Okay, yeah, like €150, is that for a weekday night, say, or would that be a weekend rate?
Well, tonight, obviously it's January, but tonight it's €110 for a double room in the hotel here.
Okay, well, obviously you are, I imagine you must be an outlier, Barry, because like I stayed in a hotel in Portlaoise on a Saturday night back, I think it was like definitely off season, kind of November, €200, no breakfast. You know, and like I said, Lisbon there now, I'm going four nights, 375. So it is, and we see this all the time, like we get so many messages in about it. And I think people are quite annoyed about that, the fact that the hotels would get this VAT rate kept down. Other sectors are facing the same economic uncertainty, Barry, you know?
Yeah, and I'm not in a position to comment on individual hotel prices only my own, but I do know, and I do have a lot of colleagues throughout the country, and there's super value to be had. I regularly travel around the country and visit different hotels, and I find if you do shop kind of early, and if you're able to plan early, and if you're able to plan your trip, there's great value to be had.
Okay.
I wouldn't consider ourselves to be an outlier. I think our rate is reflective of a lot of kind of similar properties in towns such as we're in.
Okay, if you don't get this VAT rate kept at 9%, Barry, what do you fear for the sector?
As I said, I think it will have an impact on the sector, but I think beyond that, I really feel it will deter people visiting. At the moment, we're looking at visitors whilst they're coming back. Last year, you know, 41% of Hotel Federation members were seeing a decrease in visitors from the United States, for example, which would always have been a big feeder of business to us. And I think that those sort of figures will just continue to rise, unfortunately. And as I mentioned earlier, that will lead to less people shopping and less people enjoying the various amenities and attractions in our towns and cities throughout the country if we have less footfall coming through the country.
Okay, Barry, we have one more message here to 0833 97 97 97. It says the government have paid hotels big, big money to house Ukrainian refugees. I don't have any sympathy for them now. Like, is that true? Like, you know, there are a lot of hotels who have taken in refugees and probably have gotten quite, like, well paid for it, especially in the off-season.
Yeah, I haven't had any experience with that. We have not housed refugees in my hotel. I know some have. I know a lot of hotels are keen to see those contracts end now and go back to normal trading. And I feel whatever the reasons were, some I'm sure Swedish wanted to help the Ukrainian refugees from what is a terrible situation over there. Mm. Realistically, hotels are not a long-term solution for people fleeing a war or a long-term residential option.
Of course, yeah. Well, that's Barry Kennedy there, spokesperson for the Irish Hotels Federation in the Midlands branch, calling for the 9% tourism VAT rate to be retained. Thanks very much, Barry. Because as we know, at that inquest, a baby girl did die from a dog attacking her. That was, I think, last year. And a leading dog trainer has suggested doing a few simple different things that you can get your dog prepared for the arrival of a new baby. And it comes as the government is to review legislation around dog ownership. And I'm joined on the line now by Leslie Townsend. She's a dog trainer at Clever Companions. Good afternoon, Leslie.
Hi, Cuiva. How are you?
I'm great, Leslie. First off, Leslie, look, it's a common thing now, I suppose, that couples get the dog before the baby. Mm-hmm. So I know many of my friends have no children, but they all have dogs. So it is quite usual that a newly married couple or couple in general will have a baby and they already have the dog.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, a lot of clients that I see have gotten a dog because maybe they've moved in together or they've just got married or they've gotten a house. We know that everyone's circumstances kind of changed in the last few years as well, a lot more people working from home. So lots of people get a dog before they get their baby and they look forward to raising their dog and their children together, I suppose.
Yeah, so it doesn't always go as you might expect. And I suppose you need to remember that dogs, at the end of the day, they are animals. Isn't that right, Leslie?
You do. And I think, you know, first of all, just to say my sympathies are with everyone who was involved in the very tragic circumstances that unfolded in Cork and particularly to the family and first responders. Things don't always go according to plan. And I think, you know, fortunately, not always in those kind of tragic situations. But it can be a big lifestyle change for everyone, the dog and the parents, when we bring a baby home. And so that can really mean that people are kind of struggling to cope when the baby arrives. So there's lots of things, practical things you can do once you find out you're expecting to get your dog ready for that and to get yourselves ready so that you're all set up for when your baby arrives.
Okay, so what's the first thing you should do? Like, let's say you just found out you're pregnant today, say, and you have 8 months to go. What are the first steps that people should take?
Yeah, so I suppose the first thing is start early and often. People often wait until, you know, they're nearly due. And I'm always saying to them, well, start as soon as you can, really, because a lot of the interventions that you want to introduce take some time to get right. And you don't want to be under pressure, but it's never too late to start, I suppose. But the earlier you start, the better. So the first thing I always say to clients is, you know, hire a really good qualified trainer if you need that support, because they can really help you come up with a plan together that's tailored to your lifestyle and to your needs. But the first thing to think about is you're going to need to restrict your dog's access to certain areas of the house and in the car, because what we need when we have dogs and babies together is awake, active supervision at all times. And that's really hard to achieve for anyone, for dog trainers, because, you know, you're attending to your baby, the phone rings, you turn your back, you know, you fall asleep on the couch while you're feeding your baby and your dog has unsupervised access. Yeah. When you're driving, your dog can't be on the back seat with your newborn baby in a car seat. Yeah. So these are the things we want to think about. So first and foremost, gates, crates, room dividers, they're going to make a huge difference. And you can start teaching your dog to settle on the other side of a gate or on the other side of a barrier, or to settle downstairs while you're upstairs, so that they can't get unsupervised access to your baby. Because nobody can supervise 100% of the time. And if you introduce those things now, you can really start to get your dog used to the fact that, unfortunately, they can't sleep in your bedroom anymore, but they can have a great spot on the landing, or they can be downstairs in a safe space. So that's my very first thing. And I think it's a really easy one for people to implement, because most new parents are getting, you know, baby gates and room dividers and those kind of things.
Sorry, Leslie, just to come in on there, because I actually have a message here that ties straight in with that. This woman says, I'm due my first baby in April. Most nights my dog sleeps on the bed with me and my husband. His dog bed is kept in our bedroom, but how do I move him out of the bedroom entirely?
Okay, so I get asked this question a lot, because obviously we all do a lot of co-sleeping. Without getting into too many specifics, essentially what you want to do is introduce a baby gate on the door, start gradually moving your dog's bed towards the gate. You might keep the gate open initially, and then just a few inches every night. And then as your dog gets more comfortable, a little bit further away, then you're going to start introducing the bed on the other side of the gate. Then you're going to start closing the gate. So the dog is still able to see you and hear you. And that's where working in really gradual increments can be helpful, so that you're not saying, well, I have to do this now in 3 days, because that's really unrealistic. So that's why we want to start early and often. So if you're due in April, you have a good bit of time now to start introducing that gradually and really building up to, now you're going to be sleeping on the landing. So, you know, or downstairs, for example.
Okay, sorry for interrupting you there. So back to your second point then, Leslie.
So the other point is on active and awake supervision. And I think this is really, really essential. Those gates and crates and room dividers are there for the times when you can't supervise, when you fall asleep, as we said. Think about the situations where you won't be able to supervise. So the car is a really good example. And then the other thing we want to do is learn about dog body language. So dogs give very clear signals to indicate how they're feeling in any situation. So they will let us know when they're feeling stressed or uncomfortable, when they're afraid, or when they're overexcited. And if you get really good at recognizing that body language, you'll be able to step in early when your dog is potentially going to be uncomfortable. And in line with that, I suppose, once we've got some body language in place, start playing some baby sounds. You'll find them on YouTube or you can download them off the internet at very low volume. A lot of the sounds that babies make actually sound like exciting prey animals or like squeaky toys. So it can be really arousing for a dog, really exciting or sometimes scary to hear those noises. So playing them at low volume can really help to habituate your dog to get them used to those sounds. And if you find that your dog is really overexcited or worried by the sounds of crying, for example, that's where a trainer can really help you to get your dog used to those sounds. So that by the time your baby arrives, they're like, oh, I've heard all of that before, so there's nothing to worry about.
Okay, okay, that makes sense there when you say it. But I suppose it, like, the obvious thing isn't always the done thing.
No.
Sorry, Leslie, then the third thing that people should do, like, after they try and implement those changes, so the gait first, then have the play the sounds, play the crying, and see how your dog responds. Of course, if they don't respond well, contact a trainer like yourself. And then what's the third thing?
Well, I think the other thing is to get some obedience training on the go, because we want our dog to be able to still share our lives, be in the same spaces as us. And having obedience training will really help with that. So teaching your dog to go into their bed on cue, so you can ask them to go into their bed in their safe space behind the barrier, and you can provide an activity for them. I think swapping and dropping is a really important cue to teach your dog, because babies bring loads of really interesting paraphernalia into the house, like socks and toys and bibs and nappies and all the things that dogs are interested in. So being able to ask your dog to relinquish something, to give it back to you if they've stolen it, or not to steal it at all, can be really helpful. And to be very basic about it, I think there's nothing wrong with teaching a really solid sit behaviour. So hold your fake baby in your arms, wrap up a towel or a blanket, walk around, play your baby sounds, ask your dog to sit and reward them. So they're learning that when you've got this thing in their arms, they can't be jumping up looking for attention. And I think those little basic behaviours can be really helpful. If you let your dog off lead, it's really important when you have a baby that you're able to walk with your dog, because getting out of the house with your baby and your dog is one of the big joys of family life. So if your dog is going to be off lead, get them a brilliant recall, because it's much harder to run after a dog when you've got a baby with you, and you need to have a good recall to let them off lead. And if you're walking them on lead, make sure they're able to walk beside your buggy or your pram safely, because that's going to open up a world of opportunities for you to go out with your baby, meet friends and still socialise with your dog. And I think that's really important for new parents.
Okay, that's really good advice there. I know my own dog, for some reason, well, I know the reason. If I walk her, she will pull me, like she drags me along.
Yeah.
But she won't do it for any other member of my family. So they're saying, like, Queevy, you're just spoiling her, which is probably the case.
So it's your fault.
Yeah. Is that true, though? Like, they react different to different people.
They will react differently to different people, and they definitely have different relationships with different members of the family. I suppose the most fundamental thing to understand about dog behaviour, if nothing else, is that dogs do what works, and they do what works to get them more of what they want and less of what they don't want. So when they learn to walk in a lead, your dog learns that pulling works because they get to move forward. Certainly, if your partner or other family members are taller and stronger, it might be harder for them to pull when they're walking with that person. Or they might take different kinds of walks than you do. Or you might just be more laid back with your dog. So they definitely have different relationships with us. But it is important to understand, whenever we have behaviours like that, pulling on the lead, jumping up would be one that's a big concern for people who are bringing babies into the home. Or barking is another one that a lot of new parents are worried about. Think about why that's working for your dog. So are they getting to pull you into the park, for example? Are they barking at you because you open the back door? Are they jumping on you because normally when you come into the house, they're excited to see you and you give them loads of attention? But that's not going to be practical when you have a baby in your arms or when the health nurse is coming into the house. So it's really important to think about these things now. And behaviours that seem kind of cute but annoying at the moment might be more problematic or dangerous when you have a baby in the house. And that's where having some, you know, having an assessment with a trainer, they can really spot things that you might not even think of at this stage.
Okay, well, that's great advice there from Leslie Townsend. She's a dog trainer, and of course, if you want to check her out, you can look her up online. She's from Clever Companions and giving us some great tips there on how expecting parents can prepare their dog for a new arrival. Leslie, thanks so much for joining us. That's all we have time for today. I will be back again on Monday. I was going to say tomorrow, Monday, at the same time, 2 and 3.